Windy City Queer Cast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
Windy City Queer Cast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This program is brought to you in part by American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow.
City Queercast, show number 628. I'm Amy Matheny, and happy Pride Month, everyone. We are definitely in the month of June and the beginning of Gay Pride. And, you know, for almost two decades, I have been talking about the LGBT community and our relationship to faith, religious, spiritual, on whatever level that I can, you know, bring this conversation to the forefront, I have. And I've sought out spiritual leaders, people of all faiths, to share their stories on the radio in the 90s and in the 2000s, and then since 2006 here on the podcast. And as a lesbian from East Tennessee, raised in a Christian home, I have forever championed that our community should not throw out the baby with the bathwater, not replace our spirituality with our sexuality. And I've often, many times, with co-hosts and good friends and interviewees, I've defended what I see as Christian behavior as opposed to what the religious right has called Christian. And yet, I don't think the Christian community has made it very easy for me and for others like me, because for every reconciling ministry or person of faith with an open heart, there have been hundreds of voices condemning our community. I mean, I personally have argued a certain action is not Christian or Christ-like to me, but the religious right voice has been very, very strong. And 8 months ago, I was home in Tennessee and was with a person of faith, a minister in my hometown who I've gotten very close to, especially since the passing of my grandmother. As you all know, my grandmother passed this fall at the age of 105. And she and I share this woman as a person of faith that we both talked with and shared many special times with. And she said to me, you know, I want to tell you about this man who is really blazing a trail and changing things within the Baptist community, within the Christian community. He has a surprising new voice, and it's a Baptist conservative minister, professor of ethics, who had a change of heart, and he's written about it, and Amy, you should get this book. And so what I did was I took a note, wrote down the person's name, and started Googling, as we all do. We want to know something about somebody. And then I went on Facebook and asked to follow and eventually sent a message and said, hey, you know, I'd love it if you would come on the show. And so that's happening today. I have read his most recent book, Changing Our Mind. David Gushee will be on the show the entire time with us today. So I'm thrilled. This, to me, fills me with a lot of pride to be somebody who can bring this voice, this new voice, with a new lens onto our show. And so I'm very, very excited to get started. We've got a lot also going on in the world, in the news, in the nation, and what's going on in the arts and entertainment scene in Chicago. So we're going to break for our news and entertainment. When I'm back, I'll be with David Gushee the entire show.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News. Hours after a committee in the Louisiana legislature effectively voted down a bill that would explicitly protect people and businesses that do not want to participate in same-sex marriage, Governor Bobby Jindal issued an executive order to accomplish much of what the bill had set out to do. Critics dismissed Jindal's move as an attempt to court conservatives nationally in advance of his likely presidential run.
The Illinois House passed legislation 68-43 that protects minors from anti-gay conversion therapy. House Bill 217, or the Youth Mental Health Protection Act, now moves to the state Senate.
Republican Representative Sarah Davis expressed support for same-sex marriage, becoming the first Republican state lawmaker in Texas history to publicly do so. Davis, who previously endorsed civil unions, made the comment in an interview about her decision not to sign an anti-gay marriage letter to the House Republican caucus recently issued.
Boy Scouts of America President Robert Gates called for the organization to end its ban on gay adults while speaking at the organization's national business meeting. Gates said the status quo in our movement's membership standards cannot be sustained.
A federal judge, U.S. District Judge Kelly Grenad in Mobile, Alabama, ruled that same-sex couples have the right to marry throughout the state, but she put her ruling on hold until the Supreme Court decides the issue this spring.
London Chanel, a 21-year-old black transgender woman, was stabbed to death in Philadelphia. She is the eighth trans woman of color to be killed this year in the U.S.
The Girl Scouts of the United States of America welcomes transgender girls. The group's guidance on serving transgender girls on its frequently asked questions page states that placement of transgender youth is handled on a case-by-case basis, with the welfare and best interests of the child and the members of the troop/group in question a top priority. The Girl Scouts USA cannot compel local councils to welcome everyone. Each of the 112 councils in the United States is a separate nonprofit organization.
Oregon has become the third state to ban conversion therapy. Democratic Governor Kate Brown, the first openly bisexual governor in the country, signed the bill into law.
Latournelle University, an NCAA Division III school in Longview, Texas, has banned its gay student athletes from dating and has banned all athletes from vocalizing support for same-sex marriage. The possible punishments listed for either, quote, immoral behavior includes dismissal from the athlete's team. The addition of the anti-gay language is new for the school, as the student-athlete handbook from the 2011-12 academic year did not contain any reference to homosexuality.
The Virginia Commonwealth University School of Medicine now has a course on transgender health care. Professor Dr. Taryn M. Witten had been lecturing on trans research and medicine at VCU for the past 7 years. The elective will begin this fall for fourth-year medical and nursing students.
A new study into Truvada's efficacy as a form of pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP, has found that the drug is most effective at preventing HIV contraction after a person has been taking the drug for a full week. According to the study's findings, subjects exhibited risk reductions ranging between 75 and 91% after a single day's dosage. After 3 days, risk reduction rose to somewhere between 95 and 97%. And after 5 to 7 days, the drug proved to be a 98 to 99% effective drug. An important point, the study's findings applied specifically to people who were taking Truvada at regularly scheduled intervals from day to day.
In New Jersey, state wrestling champion Alec Donovan has come out as gay. The 145-pound wrestling champion from Brick Memorial High School said revealing he is gay was a huge relief.
A bill reaffirming the rights of clergy to refuse to perform marriages, including same-sex marriages, that violate their religious beliefs has passed in the Texas House on a bipartisan vote after its sponsor reassured legislators clergy may only refuse to perform those marriages in their official capacity. State Bill 2065 passed 141-2. Openly lesbian Rep. Mary Gonzalez commended the bill's House sponsor, Rep. Scott Sanford, for carrying it. She told the floor she believes LGBT justice and religious freedom may coexist.
Rivendell Media's annual gay press report says that advertising spending in LGBT print publications for 2014 was a record high of $405.7 million. This marks the fourth consecutive year of growth and recovery from the Great Recession. The increase in ad spending persists despite a 13.8% decrease in circulation for 2014 due to fewer LGBT publications.
In world news, in Ireland, voters backed same-sex marriage by a landslide in a referendum, marking a dramatic social shift in the traditionally Catholic country, Reuters reported. Even before final votes were tallied, ministers predicted Ireland had become the first country to adopt same-sex marriage via popular vote by a margin of approximately 2-1, just two decades after it decriminalized homosexuality. The official results were announced May 23rd. 1,201,607 voted in favor of the referendum, while 734,300 voted against it. Health Minister Leo Varadkar, who revealed he is gay in January, said the referendum resembled a social revolution.
In Russia, Moscow Pride has been banned for the 10th consecutive year. Pride parades are not technically illegal in Russia. However, the country's gay propaganda law makes it an offense to promote non-traditional sexual relationships to minors, which has been used to clamp down on all LGBT activism.
A mother has had her gay son's matrimonial ad published in an Indian newspaper after three leading dailies refused. The first such advert published in a country where homosexuality is illegal. Padma Iyer placed the advert for her 36-year-old activist son, Harish, in the matrimonial pages of Midday newspaper, the largest selling tabloid in India's financial and entertainment capital of Mumbai. The ad read, "Seeking 25 to 40, well-placed, animal-loving, vegetarian groom for my son, 36, 5'11", who works with an NGO, Cast No Bar," though Iyer preferred.
The Church of Scotland has moved a step closer to allowing people in same-sex marriages to be appointed as ministers. The Kirk's General Assembly in Edinburgh voted to send the issue to presbyteries for more discussions, deferring a final decision on the issue for at least another year. The move follows a historic vote that saw the church vote in favor of allowing people in same-sex civil partnerships, not marriages, to be called as ministers and deacons.
In entertainment news, an onstage Elton John bio musical has its eyes set on Broadway and then London's West End. The project, currently titled Rocket Man the Musical, will feature the classic rock legends canon and has Tony-winning Billy Elliot book writer Lee Hall on board.
Michael Sam, the first openly gay person to be selected in the NFL draft, is going to Canada. The Montreal Alouettes have signed the defensive end, and Sam will participate in the team's upcoming training camp. The St. Louis Rams selected Sam last year, but then cut him. Sam then briefly worked with the Dallas Cowboys practice squad. His contract is $100,000 in 2015, nearly double the CFL minimum of $51,000.
Todd Haynes is Carol has been named the winner of the 2015 Queer Palm Award, a prize given to a Cannes film that deals with LGBT issues. Carol is adapted from a Patricia Highsmith novel and stars Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara as two women who fall in love in early 1950s New York.
Barbara Streisand's writing a memoir that will reflect on her life and career as an actress, singer, songwriter, and director. Viking will release the book in 2017.
Chef Art Smith will oversee an upcoming same-sex wedding on a special episode of the hit reality TV show Top Chef. Producers are reportedly looking for couples to tie the knot on the popular cooking competition. And Smith is set once again to throw his 101 gay weddings event, this time in Atlanta on June 28th. He previously held the mass gay wedding in Miami Beach. The first 101 couples to tweet hashtag 101 gay weddings to at Chef Art Smith will be invited to participate in the free wedding.
Out actor Matt Bomer is part of the remake of The Magnificent Seven. The A-list cast also boasts Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, Vincent D'Onofrio, and Peter Sarsgaard.
And Major League Baseball has launched an entire line of team-specific Pride hats and T-shirts with logos for the New York Yankees, Boston Red Sox, San Francisco Giants, Los Angeles Dodgers, Chicago Cubs, and other teams colored in rainbow hues. And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Why can't you just believe in me? Not everyone is the enemy.
Hey everybody, this is Shelley Wright, and you're listening to the Windy City Queercast with my good friend Amy.
Doing the best I can, but I'm broken.
Culture Club, Culture Club, Culture Club. Theater,
music,
dance,
art,
performance,
provocative,
hilarious,
exciting,
weird,
innovative,
campy,
edgy,
original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of June 1st, 2015, you are in Chicago's Culture Club. Hubbard Street Dance celebrates Chicago's world-renowned choreographer Alejandro Cerullo with a thrilling summer series. The program features audience favorites along with the world premiere of his newest creation. Hubbard Street's summer series runs June 11th through the 14th at the Harris Theater for Music and Dance in Millennium Park. Get the best seats now at hubbardstreetdance.com/summer. Tickets start at just $25 and are going fast.
Experience the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Doubt, a riveting story of suspicion, ambiguity, and religion, staged by Writers Theatre in the Glencoe Union Church. Explosive and riveting, a genuine stunner, says the Chicago Sun-Times. And the Tribune says Karen Janice Wodich gives one of the best performances of the year. Don't miss Doubt at Writers Theatre, just minutes from downtown Chicago on the Edensor Metra. For tickets, visit writerstheatre.org.
Lifeline Theater concludes its 32nd season of Big Stories, Up Close, with Soon I Will Be Invincible, a world premiere musical based on the 2007 superhero novel by Austin Grossman. Playing now through July 19th, more at lifelinetheater.com. Don't miss the exciting musical premiere, Soon I Will Be Invincible. And for more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
Hello, Deb Pierce here, letting you know that we'd love to hear back from you. So go ahead. You know you want to. Post a comment.
Everyone, David Gushee is one of America's leading evangelical ethicists. He is one of the most respected and highly credentialed conservative religious scholars of our time. Well, why is he on our show, you say? Well, his new book, Changing Our Mind, is a revelatory book in that he writes an apology to the community. He reveals that he has had a transformation, a spiritual transformation from one side to the other of the so-called LGBT issue. He says he's been wrong as a Baptist, as an evangelical, as a Christian. He apologizes and declares that there is an immense process evident in the path now that he is on. And even in his dedication for this book, Changing Our Mind, he dedicates the book and makes it in honor of LGBT Christians who still love a church that has not loved them. I'm really excited to just have him on to tell his story because it's a powerful one. David Gushee on the show. Hey, David, how are you?
Hi, Amy. Thank you for your kind introduction. It's great to be on your show.
Well, it's amazing. I think I just want to start. And I do this with many people I interview, but with you, really, tell us your history in the church, and how that impacted your stance or perspective on this LGBT debate within the church.
Well, I grew up Catholic, left it behind as a teenager, stumbled into a Southern Baptist church, as a 16-year-old, had a conversion experience and became one of those born-again Christians. And that was in 1978 when I was 16. 6 years later, I headed off to Southern Baptist Seminary and to become a Baptist minister. And 3 years after that, I was ordained. So born again Christian, Southern Baptist minister. Then I went to Union Seminary in New York to get a PhD in Christian ethics, and that broadened my perspective a little bit. But I still remained an evangelical Christian. Had a PhD in Christian ethics, which I've been teaching from for 22 years in Baptist schools in the South, three different ones. The real hardline conservatives probably wrote me out of the conservative community, you know, some years ago. On various issues, I've broken with conservative evangelical orthodoxy, but on the LGBT issue, I didn't say much, but what I did say was the traditional line until a few years ago when my thinking and my heart began to change. And so that's the story that I tell in the book.
Mm-hmm. Can you just tell me, just to fill in some of your story, you said that some of your theology or your perspective, not the LGBT issue, so to speak, but others. I know that you'd written a great deal on the Jewish faith. Where were some of the places where you felt like you weren't towing the line, just to give some perspective?
Yeah. Well, my dissertation was on the Holocaust, and I mean, a lot of Christians have studied the Holocaust, but not too many have taken as seriously as we needed to how much the history of Christian anti-Semitism contributed to the Holocaust. And so that, I think, permanently taught me that Christians can be wrong and can be very, very wrong, and it can have a disastrous effect.
Yeah.
When the Christian right began kind of stoking up its anti-gay rhetoric, you know, things like, remember the Disney boycott? Remember all that? You know,
yep.
I wrote against that when Southern Baptists were trying to do a Disney boycott, and that wasn't popular.
Mm-hmm.
After 2001, when the U.S. started torturing people, I led, or was one of the leaders, of a Christian resistance to that, saying no Christian can support torture for any reason.
Yep.
But you know, all of my stands are rooted in my understanding of what it means to be a follower of Jesus and my understanding of the Bible. So my evangelical methodology and loyalty to that kind of serious, biblical, devout Christianity hasn't gone away. But for a long time, some of the conclusions that I drew from those premises have looked a little different from the Christian right type folks.
Well, and I remember years and years and years ago, one of my first podcasts was back in 2006, and I interviewed Reverend Mel White, and he really schooled me a little bit on the word evangelical. He said, you know, the evangelical, to me, you know, being evangelical means you're bringing the good news of Jesus Christ. And what I hear you saying, and I hear that you're working with young people, you know, in the university system, and you're a teacher, and it's very apparent here in 2015, and you talk about this in the book, that the millennials, you know, the next generation is leaving the church, that somehow what's happening in the world and what they're hearing in their church, they cannot, and I'm using adopting this word even though I don't really love it, but they cannot reconcile it. The perspective that they're hearing on LGBT community, when these are people that are their friends, that are their colleagues, their family members, that they cannot relate that feelings of the personal with the theological that's being taught to them. Was that going on in your life as well, or was it the reflection of what you saw in young people growing up in this day and this time?
I have had the great privilege of spending my entire career teaching young people, which has kept me at least somewhat relevant and up to date on what's going on. So that's been cool. But I would say that the main thing that began to shake up my categories was after I moved to Atlanta in 2007 to take a position at Mercer, where I still teach, which is a more of a progressive Baptist school here in Atlanta and in Macon. I teach college students and seminary students, so I get to see both cohorts. But anyway, after 2007, I moved out of a kind of a hermetically sealed conservative Baptist world where you never really encountered gay people because they were mainly closeted or had fled.
Yeah.
And came to a place where there were LGBT people in my local congregation and more over time, Baptist church, and a few in my seminary and a few of my undergraduate students. And then eventually, very dramatically in our family, my youngest sister came out as a lesbian in her late 30s. And so it was a series of experiences with people that made a really big difference and drove me back to a reconsideration of the biblical sources that are most widely cited on this issue. But, you know, the millennials have grown up in a society in which social acceptance of LGBT people has been growing, in which the stark biblically cited, you might say, or biblically based condemnations of gay people are at stark variance with the people, the human beings, the precious human beings that they know at school and as friends and so on. And that clash has become increasingly problematic for them. And in general, to the extent that evangelical Christianity has defined itself as anti-gay and anti-gay rights, it has hurt itself across American society, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I imagine that, you know, that your sister, I mean, really was, like you said, brought it so from the theological and even perspective to such a deeply personal level. I know for many people that can be very clarifying. I like when you say this, and it's in your introduction, but I think it's a really big question right now that leads me to, like, why write a book? You have a thing where you said, you say that most established evangelical leaders remain stuck in their ways, or at best simply at a loss for how to move forward. Many older, more conservative church members threaten to pull their support from anyone who shifts their thinking, preventing pastors and others from seriously grappling with this issue. That dynamic repels many of our most promising young people, and the result, the church is losing one of its best hopes for a thriving future, and the very change agents who could help to reverse these downward trends. Understandably, this situation leaves many pessimistic about the place of the church in the 21st century. So did you feel this was a calling? Did you feel this was a quest? Because you don't have to write a book. You could just teach differently. You could just be an awesome, awesome brother to your sister. You could, you know, stay there in your slightly more progressive, small, you know, Baptist college, you know, behind the ivy wall, so to speak, and, you know, your world not be rocked and you not try to rock anybody else's world. But you're rocking some people's world, and I can't imagine this is popular in your professional community for you to have written this book. So why write the book?
You know, I had been increasingly uneasy. And actually, since the book came out, my students of different years, like when they took ethics with me in 2011, they said, "Oh yeah, you were beginning to raise questions in 2012." You know, so it was gradual, and my students were seeing it. And yes, I could have just kind of kept it quiet, but it did feel like a strong sense of calling, divine calling. I don't know. It's a couple of different things. I've written about almost everything else. I've written 19 other books.
Right.
And to not write about this issue when I've written about just about everything else felt like being a coward, or would have felt like being a coward, ducking and running when something needed to be said. Also, I have tenure, and I have... I have a school that supports me.
Yep.
In fact, the official policy of Mercer is inclusive. So Mm-hmm. I had less to lose than a lot of other people who might have also wanted to go down the same path.
And yet I will say, because when you were saying all this, I was thinking of, for me, for my personal relationship, you know, when I right before I started working in radio and talking with LGBT people about their lives, I had kind of, I left the church. I had not left God, but I had kind of left the church. It just didn't feel like those four walls or that fellowship was really where I was going to commune with God. And that was kind of a decision not made for me, but I was in acceptance of it. And I heard Reverend Peter Gomes on Charlie Rose one night, and he was talking about his book, The Good Book. And I was thinking, as you were just talking, you know, his last chapter was like the LGBT question, the community, the final frontier. He'd gone through women and Jewish people. And for people who don't know, he has passed. But Peter Gomes was the Anglican, African-American, Republican head of divinity at Harvard. But I mentioned Reverend Mel White. I mentioned Peter Gomes, who I never got to interview. I would have loved to. But these are two gay men. And I have said all along, it's really going to take our straight allies to change our story and radically change things for our community. So it is a whole other thing as a straight man to put yourself out on the line and go, yeah, I have talked about everything else, and now I need to be really firm on my stance on LGBT people. I mean, I don't want you to lighten at all what you've done, because I know you've had backlash. I mean, I am sure you have. It doesn't go without incident to stand as firmly as you are in saying we're wrong and we should be apologizing as Christians to the LGBT community, and especially our LGBT Christian brothers and sisters.
There has been backlash. I've lost friends over this. I've gotten all kinds of, hate mail and various kinds of social media, the things people can do on social media that make your life uncomfortable. But I've also heard from or met or become friends with, hundreds and hundreds of LGBT Christians and ex-Christians and exiled Christians. And, mm-hmm. And it's like a new branch of the Christian community. This is this underground kind of suffering, beautiful group that, has, it's like I've lost old friends, but I've gained a lot of new friends, and I like the new friends better.
It's a good tribe. I mean, you say in your book you think Jesus would be standing with the persecuted LGBT community. But why are so many other ministers and Christian leaders not brave enough to stand with the community? What is the big fear, David?
Well, for some, they can't get there biblically because they're used to the six big passages that I go through in the book, and that's all that there is that's relevant. And so they can't get there biblically. They want to be loving, but they can't figure it out theologically or biblically, and so they're kind of paralyzed. They're mute. So there's that. Mm-hmm. But I've also run into, you remember the story of Nicodemus, the Jewish leader who comes to Jesus at night? And he comes at night because he's afraid to be seen with Jesus during the day. There are a lot of Nick at Night characters who have contacted me to say, hey, I'm with you, but I just can't say anything because, I've got a young family, and if I come out as an ally, I'll lose my church, and I don't know who would hire me, and I don't know how I'd take care of my family. And it's the same kinds of pressures that have kept people quiet in the face of injustice in every generation. Too much to lose.
That's a reality. Yeah. Everybody can't come out, and we've talked about that for years of like, because I do think with podcasting, with radio, I've often said it's been a wonderful medium for me to talk with closeted brothers and sisters, because it's like air, right? Talking is vapor. It's not like picking up a gay magazine or buying a gay book, or you're probably not going to get caught, in your car with your earbuds in nowadays, listening to whatever it is you want to listen to. And so it has been a way for people to come together and to talk. And I totally am not a fan of outing people or even thinking that everyone should be out. I definitely think that we have to challenge ourselves to find courage. And that's what I see you being an example of so beautifully.
Thank you.
Tell me about these Bible verses. I mean, others have debunked them. You say some religious leaders can't get there theologically, and yet I say there's probably as many books now written that debunk these biblical passages historically and theologically as there are that support them. So how is your approach new? And I also think there's some that you've chosen not to approach. So can you talk about that?
Well, what you have is actually a pretty small body of passages that even mention same-sex activity. None of them mention sexual orientation because it wasn't a concept. So you have a passage from Leviticus. You have the Sodom and Gomorrah story, which now pretty much everybody realizes is about gang rape. The Leviticus passage, you're dealing with what do we do with Old Testament law in general, and why, you know, and do we really cite Leviticus for anything else? You know, so there's that problem. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you have one or two words in 1 Corinthians 6:9 that are very difficult to translate, but that have been translated in ways that sound more decisive than the Greek would justify. Right. And another passage like that in 1 Timothy 1. But the two main texts really are Romans 1, where you have those very harshly condemnatory words from Paul related to those who exchange natural for unnatural relations. And then the only substantial theological theme, and I think themes are more important than specific passages, but the theme of a divine order of creation in which people are made male and female and male for female from Genesis 1 and 2, and the echoes of that passage in the Bible. I think that it's that theme that I do the most original work on, because it's that theme, some combination of the biblical and the sense of what is natural, mm-hmm. that was most difficult for me to get past, and most difficult for a lot of my co-religionists to get past. You know, the idea that there's a story that we live by, and that the creation, it's like a grand mega story, and there's a God, and God creates the world, and one of the things that God creates is humans, and humans come in two types, male and female, and then that's how the species is propagated, and male belongs with female, and female with male, and so what I do basically is to raise like three different possible ways of reading that story while also taking seriously the reality of the lives of LGBT people. Mm-hmm. And one of the first things I say is we actually do have to take seriously the lives, actual lives, concrete, stubborn lives of LGBT people who are either not fitting with the gender binary or are not fitting with the attraction for the supposed opposite sex. And I think it's there for the devout evangelical Christian, or most Christians historically, the way they organize their mental framing of reality is by reading the Bible. Mm-hmm. And the Bible has this story, and this story is retold. Of all the stories in the Bible, this one is told, you know, in churches about as much as any of the other ones or more. And so what a weakness of a heavily Bible-focused religion is sometimes, it doesn't have to be this way, but sometimes, like, when human beings don't fit the story, then the human beings are the problem. The human beings are disconfirming evidence for the biblical story that is so cherished and that helps people's world make sense. So here's a gay person, or here's a transgender person. They are a problem to the narrative. And so instead of saying, how do we find a way to make the narrative and the people cohere? Can we think creatively about that? Instead, they shut down the people because the people are a threat to their worldview. Mm. And so that's why you have to have, like, ex-gay therapy, because if we can just grind out of existence, you know, same-sex attraction, then we don't have the problem for our worldview.
Yeah.
Or if we can just kind of shame people, then they feel so ashamed that they'll either give up their same-sex attraction, or they'll give up the identity, or they'll give up acting on it.
Yeah.
And but we now have generations of clinical and human evidence that all this does is hurt people, hurts them deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, I think that the plea that I make in the book that, I mean, gay people have been saying for years, but they haven't been listened to because they've been stigmatized. They're like the problem. And so their account of reality has been ignored. This is one reason why you need allies. But as I basically said, we need to be able to cohere stubborn human reality with the biblical narrative that we cherish. And there are some ways to do that. If we don't do it, what we do, if we don't find a way to cohere these and bring them together, what we do is we destroy people. We destroy them psychologically. We destroy them spiritually. We destroy them morally. We destroy them in terms of a relationship with Christ. And we break up families and create all kinds of misery that, you know, you and your listeners know very well what that misery is.
Yeah.
And so when you move and you kind of zoom out to the broader themes of the Bible and you ask about what does love look like and what does justice look like and what does human dignity look like and what about a religion that brings good and life rather than bad and harm to people, then the six Bible passages begin to take their place as one thing you have to deal with. But the bigger picture is, what about these human beings who are precious in God's sight, who we have harmed? How do we stop harming them?
So this is a loaded question, but you're not a liberal.
No.
So
no.
You have principles, conservative principles, on what it means to be Christian that guide you. And so you are bringing people, which you say may not fit a construct, into that channel. Is that the right way of me saying this? I guess what I'm wanting to have you talk about then is why would you not be considered a liberal or a social liberal? Because I want you to talk a little bit about, you know, the use of sexuality or the role of sexuality or sex as you see
right.
in adult Christian lives. And this is where I think everybody on my show is not going to agree with you.
Right.
But I don't want everybody to agree with any person I have on the show or it's not interesting. It's one filter. And this is the way I think, you know, people are like, gay Republicans, that's got to be an oxymoron or, you know, that's a, you know, uh-huh. it's a paradox or whatever. But, you know, we come in all shapes and sizes. We have all cultures. We have all histories. We have all ethnicities. We have all, you know, the LGBT or sexuality part of us is one lens. And I see that your principle, your primary guiding lens is as a Christian. So how does that impact then a way that you kind of come in the middle to help possibly more conservative Christians and the LGBT community, meet in a different place? I think there's a lot of different places to come to. You're not actually asking Christian people to change. You're not actually asking Christian people to change or gay people to change. You're just saying, this is my perspective on a thing, and I've changed. So talk to me a little bit about the role of sex and the role of a sexual relationship for LGBT people or LGBT people as Christian people.
Yeah. One of the things I've been trying to say consistently is, I think fundamentally this is not a sexual ethics problem. This is a human dignity problem. We have a version of the predominant version of Christianity, which has stigmatized and shamed and degraded 5%, you know, or so of the human population. It's 5% of them. That would be 5% of everybody in the church until they get driven out, right? So above all, it's a human dignity problem. And I also say it's a gospel problem because we say that God loves everybody, but what we have done with our actions is to essentially say God doesn't love the LGBT community.
Right. And or doesn't love the LGBT community the same way he loves other people.
That's right.
That
yeah.
God would have parameters on his love, that his love would, you know, would be like our love, would have conditions.
Right. And it's also a church problem because we have folks who are in the churches and instead of nurturing their faith, we end up destroying it. So so it's a dignity issue. It's a gospel issue. It's a church issue. It's only fourth or fifth, a sexuality issue in the sense of what people should do with their bodies. But, I mean, what I say in the book is that the best biblical and Christian tradition on sexuality is covenantal / marital. And that is recognizing that, that most people are, you know, are sexually active, interested in having a partner, having some way to express themselves sexually and romantically, relationally. They want that one person to bond with, or at least at some point they do. And the Christian faith has said, if you're straight, what you can do with that drive and that hunger is you can marry somebody, and then you're supposed to stay married for life and be faithful to that person.
Right.
What we have what we've said to gay people is you don't have a legitimate option. You must stay celibate or change, right? You got nothing.
Right.
Okay. And so all I'm saying in the book is, what if we invited gay people into the same covenantal marital ethics that we have always invited straight people to?
So then you would be a proponent. Then you would be for same-sex marriage.
Yeah. In fact, I would say, okay. So some conservative Christians say, oh, but you know, gay people are promiscuous. Well, so are a lot of straight people. But the issue there, I think, a lot of when you tell a community of people there is no legitimate sexual expression for you, in a sense, what you do is you drive their sexuality underground or into the shadows,
right?
And you create the conditions for a kind of a rebellion and a chaos that doesn't end up working very well for people. I think most of the time.
Yeah.
So if you bring sexuality out of the shadows back into the light, a light where God can be brought in and where you have a recognizable biblical standard that can be applied, that the only standard we have that has some history to it and that works better than any other alternative, it seems to me, is covenantal and marital. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, yes, we need sex, and yes, we need a partner. But because we're sinful and fickle, our tendency is to fall in and out of love and make commitments and break them. Mm-hmm. And that ends up hurting a lot of people, especially children who are, you know, left behind. So I say, let's have everybody play by the same covenantal standard and support, encourage, and challenge everybody in the Christian community to meet that standard, which would involve a lot of reform on the part of everybody, given our divorce rates and everything else, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I said, because obviously we've talked a lot about same-sex marriage, especially in the past year and a half, as the conversation is amped up, at least in the United States, we don't even know as LGBT people what it would be like. I think we will be normal human being people, which is what we are, that we will have probably the same divorce rates and we will make mistakes in marriage and we will have successes in marriage. We don't know what will come of a decade or two decades or, you know, 50 years of LGBT people being able to legally marry, because, you know, we're being held to some standard where we've never had familial support for our relationships. We've never had community support for our relationships. We've never had church or religious institutions support our relationships. And I think that straight heterosexual people take it for granted how many institutions and ways of life support their relationships, even when they're dating somebody. You know, people are like, when are you going to get really serious? When are you going to have children? When are you going to take this relationship to the next level? And I think as LGBT people, there is no level. It's like you either have somebody in your life or you don't. There's no deepening of a relationship. And yet, what I will say, and I wrote this somewhere in your book, and I'm trying to remember, Oh, I know. It's here on your in chapter 16. You're talking about this covenant. I cannot say that word. Covenantal marital. It's a hard word to say. Ethic. That you say, you know, you can see it in generations that your father, my father just buried my mother. They were married for 53 years. My parents also are married 53 years. They did it right. But few of the generation currently under the age of 35 will ever see a 50-year marriage again. And I wrote, when I was reading that, when I was finishing your book last night, I wrote in the margins, I know at least five very close to me long-term gay or lesbian couples who have not been able to marry, who have been together 25 to 35 years. And I'm a young 40 person, you know, so I'm talking about people who I know in their 40s and 50s who got together and have survived their 20s and 30s. And I think, wow, if you gave us a chance as a community to have support, just in those five couples I know alone, who now have gone to New York or now been married in Illinois, and we all kind of laugh buying them, you know, wedding cards like, welcome to this beginning of your relationship. And I want to be like, oh my God, they need new cards that say like, you know, congratulations on doing this 25 years with no support except supporting and loving one another. And if you have a beautiful relationship with the quiet God of your understanding, then, you know, you have probably connected deeply to that and sustained this relationship, because I actually know the opposite. I have been to so many heterosexual, I've been to multiple heterosexual weddings of many, many friends, bought the gifts, and on wedding number two, you know, setting up for wedding number three. And then I had these LGBT people who I'm going to their first wedding and they've been together 25, you know, 30 years. I'm really excited to see what that could look like. And I'm of a different belief that I don't know if it's for everybody, because I'm not sure, but I sure will be interested to see, you know, what that will look like, hopefully still in my lifetime, to have a history, of what that will look like when all those communities can come and support, you know, people have dealt with difficult things and being different and, because I don't know how long it'll be before that's not evident in our society.
You know, this is I keep learning so much on this journey, and the more people that I know, the more textured and nuanced my understanding of this whole situation gets. Such a gift to me. I'm learning so much. But one of the things I've learned is I think LGBT Christians in particular are a voice of renewal. You think about, for example, all the numbers on church attendance are declining. We just keep seeing statistics that tell us this. So people who can go to church without anybody bashing them are losing interest.
Yep.
And now here's this population that would like to be in church and has to fight to be in church. And when they get a chance to be in church, there's something very beautiful and renewing about that, you know. And that's been our congregational experience. Same thing with marriage. Here, you know, heteros can marry at the drop of a hat, whether they're serious about it or not.
Right.
And then do it again, and then do it again, and do it again, and get, you know, some kind of rituals of support, a lot of money, and all that. And you know, and here's LGBT folks who haven't had that opportunity. And so maybe the extension of gay marriage can be a renewal for the permanence and meaningfulness and beauty of marriage as it should be. You know,
I agree. Maybe, I totally think that, you know, it's always said like, oh, we will harm marriage, you know, that gay people getting married will ruin the sanctity and ruin the institution of marriage. And I want to say, do you know that when you actually give people the privilege of doing something they've been denied, how much they revere it? It's like you see that movie Selma, and you watch the scene with Oprah Winfrey when she's that black woman in Selma, you know, who wants to go and vote, and how hard she has to work and fight for that vote, and people choose not to vote today. You know, it's like, I very much agree with you that I think it's the exact opposite. Either we will do nothing to impact heterosexual marriage at all, or, you know, straight people. And there was just a news story I did just a couple of weeks ago about the percentages of Republicans, independents and Democrats who would attend a same-sex marriage. And it was actually fairly high for all, it was a Gallup poll or something. But I think, you know, bearing witness to two, you know, gay men in the city of Chicago who've been together 28 years, finally being able to get married, I just believe that's what Christ was talking about the witness of our lives and how we live our lives that can't help but change mind, you know, change minds and change the world. And I think it's the exact opposite. I think either we won't impact heterosexual marriage or all, or we will help the institution of marriage in a great way.
I think that's right. I mean, the tragedy, I think, what I see coming up is more and more young people and just people in general, including Christians, are going to watch with their eyes what is actually happening, and attitudes will change, and LGBT people will find more and more acceptance. But there will still be a sizable minority, perhaps louder and angrier as they as their numbers shrink, who just don't get it, who don't support it, who don't see it. And you know, I think we will likely see that for the next 20 or 30 years. But I've made my choice. You know, I'm standing in solidarity with what I say in the book is the church's own most oppressed group, and nobody's going to turn me around on that. And the blessing of getting to know this community and be in their lives and be an ally for them is it's one of the coolest things that's ever happened in my life.
Wow. Well, it's one of the coolest things to have you on the show. I have to tell you, it feels like a full circle moment. This book, I mean, we've been talking and maybe this sounds like a lot of, you know, complex, in-depth conversation. Hopefully it doesn't. Hopefully it just sounds like a conversation, because I really didn't prep a ton for this because I felt like I don't need to. I just am excited to talk to you. But I did read your book, and I have to say it's a slim book. I mean, it's 126 pages that are packed, you know, they're chocked full, but a very clear, easy lay person to read. You know, I mean, David has a lot of wonderful titles and acclaim with his name, but this book is a very easy to digest, a straightforward book. It's really, to me, a personal story, and with all its twists and turns, because this is a complicated story. But I know you are changing minds, and I know, you know, I know that one part of an equation changes, everything changes. And so I'm very excited to have you as a new voice and a new ally for our community. I know that in your foreword, Tyler Clementi's mom is, you know, is referenced, Mitchell Gold, who many people know, who has, done a lot with not only making wonderful furniture, stylish, fashionable furniture, but has, you know, made this a mission as well with his faithinamerica.org website. As also, you have so many wonderful people from the Human Rights Campaign and others who are seeing the work that you're doing. And we, as I said, we have to, you know, link arm in arm with our straight allies, because they really are going to pave the way for change for us as a community. We can only do so much, preach into the choir, so to speak. Pun intended. David, how can people follow you? How can they get to know, like, you might be coming? Because our show's heard around the world. So if you're speaking somewhere, or how to get your book, or in many of your books, or, you know, tell me how people can find out more about you and just get engaged with the mission work, the ministry work that you're doing.
Yeah, I'm active on social media. On Twitter, it's @DPGushy. And happy to be friended on Facebook, just David Gushy. I have a website, davidpgushy.com, where I try to get my speaking appearances updated, at least periodically. It's not as active as I'd like it to be. I'm going to work on that. And Read the Spirit Publishers did this book, Changing Our Mind, and so you could order it from their website, readthespirit.com, I believe, or Amazon or any other place. It's also on Kindle, and so it's getting some pretty wide circulation, and I'm excited about that. Yeah.
I mean, normally I'm like, oh, I know I'm supposed to sell a book, but I have to just tell you, this is a book I just think people should read. I mean, I'm not trying to do a hard sell. I mean, I think that if you've been a part of this conversation at all throughout the years, listening to my shows and listening to me and Mitchell, we argue on the couch. And, you know, I definitely, you know, have gone toe to toe with his atheism or whatever, or his anger at the religious right. But, you know, I'm going to buy a copy of this from Mitchell and say, hey, just read it, you know, because the story is changing. So I'm not trying to change someone's beliefs, but I do think it's changing a fabric of society and how we will all live together in all of our diversity. So I'm really excited. David P. Gushy, the book is called Changing Our Mind. We will have his website, Read the Spirit, also his changingourmind.org website, all linked in our show notes. You can go right there to click through and get the book or find out more. Thank you so much for being on with me today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. Let's do it again sometime.
Got something to say? Call us today, 312-21-BE-GAY. Well, everyone, thank you so much. Happy Pride. Welcome to the first week of June, and happy Pride. Thank you for being a part of this very special podcast. And thank you to those of you who have reached out to me via email or Facebook or in other ways to say that you heard the news about the podcast coming to a close with me as it stands here at the end of June. And I just wanted to say thank you. That means a lot. And for those of you who perhaps missed last week's podcast, just a little recap. The Queercast with me as the host and as we know it as being a weekly podcast is going to end here on at the end of June, hopefully with the announcement and the final ruling on the Supreme Court case on same-sex marriage. So I'll be talking about it a little bit the next few weeks, but there's so many wonderful things that I have gotten from all of you listening and all of the people that have contributed to the Queercast and all of the people that I've gotten to speak with, have conversations with over these almost 10 years, almost 9 years on the podcast and 9 years in radio before this. So I'm coming up on a lot of years, folks, talking to LGBT people. But I just thank you and did want to let people know that these are the last few Queercasts. Savor them as I am. But don't forget that all of the Queercasts will always be on our site and downloadable in our archives as they always are for free. So I'm going to appreciate this end of this journey with you guys over the next few weeks and over Pride Month. Coming up next week, it is the high holidays, the Tony Awards. That's right. And I hope you've got your televisions tuned for this Sunday. So Scott Duff, Scotty D, and I will be watching this week and reporting to you on how it all goes down. So our Tony show is next week. And then some upcoming shows, hopefully with some old friends popping in to say hi and say bye and say bon voyage, and all of that good stuff. So lots to come in this Pride Month, lots of celebration and lovely weather, at least today, so I'll take it. Have a good week, everyone. Bye-bye. I got nothing much to say. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast. Queer and now.